Well, good evening and welcome to the DMSE Masterclass hosted by A.T. Still University's Doctor of Medical Science program. Before we begin, a few reminders for our attendees. Please keep your microphones muted and feel free to share any comments or questions in the chat section during the presentation. We'll have a Q&A session at the end, where you can unmute yourself, and Dr. Beth Popray, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat for any questions or comments. Tonight, I'm so excited we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. David Bunnell, President-elect of the American Academy of PAs and faculty in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the University of Maryland, in Baltimore. Dr. Bunnell's career exemplifies the versatility and leadership potential of the PA profession. With over 20 years of clinical experience in cardiac electrophysiology, cardiothoracic surgery, and surgical critical care, he has bridged clinical excellence with educational innovation. His work focuses on competency-based medical education and the integration of artificial intelligence in healthcare, topics that are certainly increasingly vital to our profession. Tonight, we'll explore his journey from emergency medicine to becoming a national leader, his insights on the future of PA education, and his pioneering work with artificial intelligence in healthcare. So, welcome, Dr. Bunnell.
Thank you so much. These master classes are such a wonderful tradition at AT Stills, and it's really an honor to be a part of it.
Well, Dave, your path into healthcare began long before PA school. Can you tell us about your early years in emergency medical services and how those 20 years shaped your perspective on patient care? What drew you to EMS initially, and how did these formative experiences influence your clinical approach?
So I was young. I was 16-year-old EMT, and I really followed the crowd. The crowd went to the fire department, and I followed that crowd. But I found the ambulances that were there, and I really found my people. And both between the fire service and an EMS in suburban Johnstown, Pennsylvania at the time, I gotta say, these folks were larger than life. Like they were these amazingly huge personalities. EMS, as it was and still is in some places in rural areas, really need all hands on deck. So an able-bodied 16-year-old who was interested and could learn quickly, fit in well with that crowd. So I became a 16-year-old EMT who spent half of his day every day in my senior year of high school on ambulances and an 18-year-old paramedic. And it was just an amazing opportunity to learn at every level. I could, really write a book about those experiences and how they affected my life.
Wow, as a former firefighter myself, and back in the day in the late 1970s, where EMTs were fairly new and there were no paramedics, thank you for your experience at that time. You and I, we've talked earlier, and you mentioned that you were introduced to the PA profession, through your wife, Captain Rebecca Bunnell. What was it about the PA model that resonated with you, and what led you to enroll at George Washington University? And what was your experience like at GW's PA program? And who were the mentors that had the greatest impact on your education? That's a lot of questions all at once, but I think you got it.
I'll navigate my way through. So I had never heard of the PA profession until I had some colleagues in EMS that were in PA programs. A friend of mine actually just retired from the PA profession, was going to Duquesne, but one of my partners was going to Chatham in one of the early days at Chatham in Pittsburgh. And friends said, gosh, I'm going out to dinner with this person, this Rebecca person, and I met her and we never stopped going to dinner. And I heard about the PA profession as I started dating her in her clinical year of PA education. But she had joined the United States Public Health Service. And so I got really acquainted with uniform service. And I finally followed her out to to New Jersey, and really, as I was working through as a paramedic in northern New Jersey in 2000, 2001, she was starting her PA career, and I really got to live vicariously through what was happening in her career, and really came to understand it as really a place where you could start care. I ended up at we ended up back from New Jersey into Maryland. And in Maryland, I had a chance to do a fellowship at NIH while I was sorting things out. And while current days, you know, there's this huge strategy for how people apply to PA schools, right? They have the CASP applications, they're applying to 7 and 10 places. I had no strategy. I just looked, and the closest place I could think of was GW. I applied to it, and just dumb luck got in, and really was just so grateful for that opportunity and for the people. And I got to say that, you know, it was almost an embarrassment of riches because, and I didn't know it at the time. Like, yes, of course people are teaching your PA class, like Jeff Heinrich, who was the director, and Jackie Barnett and Howard Straker and Jim Colley, and you know, I mean, just just that huge depth of the PA program, who just happened to be the people walking around at that time. So that experience was really, really wonderful. I'm sure I missed part of that question, but I navigated my way through a little bit.
No, you did good. And first of all, please give our best to your wife and thank her for her service. And
Indeed.
you know, and you're using the names of giants in our profession, Jeff Heinrich, Jim Colley, a number of folks like that, you know, that we continue to stand on the shoulders of giants, and that's who they are.
That's right.
So, you know, so despite your extensive emergency medicine background, you discovered at some point your passion was in surgery. Can you walk us through the transition from emergency medicine at the Hospital of St. Raphael to become the first PA in cardiothoracic surgery at the West Haven VA Medical Center? And what challenge did you face being the first PA in that department?
Yeah. So turns out I loved being a paramedic. Didn't love being a PA in the ER. For all the reasons that make emergency medicine practice complicated to this day. You know, there's if anything, it's gotten more complicated and challenging. And I recognized that in during my PA education. But when I landed in the surgical practices, I found my people. I found, you know, I described the folks in my early days of EMS and the fire service that I just felt that these larger than life folks, you know, as it turns out, there's not a 911 for 911, right? You know, no one else is coming. So that kind of larger than life personality I found in surgery, the folks that you called when things were in trouble. There was not a surgeon to save the surgeon. So I found that thing that I loved. And as it turns out, I did my last rotation at the West Haven VA and was offered a job in surgery and cardiothoracic surgery and surgical critical care. But it just took them so long to do the paperwork. You know, a month off after school is a vacation. 4 months or more feels like unemployment. So I went looking for employment and found myself at the Hospital of St. Raphael. And it was an amazing experience. But it certainly some and it cemented my just I did it was not my space. It was not my home. There was just, you know, the chaos in it was very, very different than the emergency medical services, where it was more of a controlled chaos in that space. So that's how I ended up at the West Haven VA, where honestly I've got myself a rotation. I kind of cold called the place because I knew Rebecca was going to get stationed there. And fortunately, I found through my way through to the NP that worked there, and she connected me to the head surgeon. So I spent my last rotation at GW there, just really had this amazing experience with unbelievable people doing things that people only imagine of. But it turns out that you I was the first PA there, meaning two things. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, and neither did they. So I went to the internet as it was and found the Association of PAs in Cardiothoracic and Vascular Surgery. And I started going to their conferences. And at that time, it was every 6 months. So for a couple of years, I was there every 6 months. And I asked everybody I could find, what do you do? And some people, they all said, oh, I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon. I said, no. What? That's your job title. What do you do? And some people would say, well, I take out pacer wires and write discharge summaries, and I'm in a cardiac surgery PA. I said, oh, okay, that's not exciting, but I get it, part of the job. Some people would say, oh, I open up chests and put people on cardiopulmonary bypass, and I'm a cardiac surgery PA. So I learned that there was this huge diversity, this huge spectrum of what the practice was. So I really had an opportunity to both learn through our professional association and with these surgeons. And essentially, West Haven was Yale West. You know, essentially all these amazing people from around the world to learn from, to be able to kind of define my practice and bring myself along. So through, you know, the good graces of just amazing surgeons around me and our professional associations, I found my way.
Wow. Well, as a veteran, and I get my primary care from the VA clinic up in Battle Creek, Michigan. I really thank you, for being part of that system. You spent nearly 2 decades, if I understand that correctly, in the VA system. And again, thank you for your service to veterans. What does serving veterans mean to you personally? And how did that experience shape your understanding of healthcare delivery?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for your service. It was my privilege to serve those who served. But I can say that, you know, it recall that there was a book a while back that somebody wrote, and it was supposed the guy who was writing it thought he was going to do a hit piece on the VA. And really got on the inside. And at the end of the day, ended up writing a book called Best Care Anywhere. And I really believe that. So you hear a lot of things about VA, but VA is a very complicated system. So if you're mad about something, maybe I'm mad with you. Because what are you mad about? I mean, is, you know, did you have problems with benefits or cemetery or, you know, it goes on and on and on. But I could find that as my friends who were veterans who were coming back from 20 years of war, and I would kind of hear them really struggle, and the struggle was the same. It was the difficulty accessing the care. It was once people were in the system, people felt they were cared for. And that was this amazing experience that I had, is that I'm a friendly guy and I'll pick up the phone. And between being at the West Haven VA and spending most of my time at the Washington, D.C. VA, I really got to know people in the system, meaning that because we were a tertiary care facility, so we had folks coming from all directions to us. But creating those relationships in the community-based outpatient clinics and the other hospitals really gave me an opportunity to connect care locally. So maybe I didn't need to drag you all the way into DC to get blood work because I know a guy out on the Eastern Shore, or I know somebody up in the mountains in the Shenandoahs. That kind of a connection system, I wish everybody had.
Yeah, well, wow, well said. Dave, your leadership journey began, if I understand this correctly, with the Association of PAs in Cardiothoracic and Vascular Surgery. Can you describe your progression from leadership fellow to president and what you learned about leadership along the way? And, what were the key initiatives you championed during your presidency? And how did serving as chief delegate for 10 years, prepare you for broader leadership roles? Again, multiple questions here.
Well, I can tell you that without the APA CVS, you're not talking to me today. I can say that that formative experience from the first days at the West Haven VA, where I was saying, I don't know what I'm doing and I need help, they provided me the entree into care, both understanding the specialty clinically and what it saw to have the leaders around me, because the APA CVS is an historic organization, more than 40 years old. So I really had a chance there to meet and work with and for the leaders in those spaces. And I think about it in a number of different levels. I think one of the things that I say as a joke is I probably should get an MBA for all of our work in that work, because we have, it's a business. All these organizations are business. So to learn how to run these businesses in a way that stays true to mission and stays on board was a massive organization. Because when you made a mistake, it wasn't a case study. You lost real money, and you put real things into risk. So that was one aspect of just the business aspect of it. But the organizational leadership journey, really, I hate using these God words like journey or things that sound like I was on a camel or something, but I can say that it really was an epic journey. This concept of a kid just walking in the door, and yes, I had a lot of EMS experience, but just willing to pitch in and ask questions and be a part of the story, is it started with a leadership fellow position that enabled me to have a non-voting position on the board, and you did projects for the board, and then I ran for positions. I ended up holding every single office and a few that we made up along the way, and that was just this amazing experience and experience of what is it really like to work with people from around the country before we're doing Zoom and all of these kind of telephone conference calls, doing these complicated things. Really form me to be able to make those steps in along the journey. You mentioned my time in the House of Delegates, and that was really between my experience at APA CVS, knowing my specialty, that really introduced me to the world of the PA universe. And it was because at the time, the way it worked is that there hadn't been too many delegates from APA CVS. There was Dana Gray, and he came in, and I was his alternate 1 year, and he couldn't have been more generous and wonderful, introducing me to the whole world, saying, "Hey, this is my last year, and this is the new guy. Talk to this guy." He introduced me to the whole room. And I had an opportunity to really spend 10 years as the chief delegate from APA CVS, really engaging deeply in our governance process, which I have tremendous respect for. And being able to meet really the people, the history of our profession, and to be able to kind of create our present and our future. So just a tremendous experience that I really cherished.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing up Dana Gray, another giant in our
Yes.
profession. So, let's talk a little bit about the AAPA. You've held numerous significant positions, from chairing the Research and Strategic Initiatives Commission to serving as a liaison to the AMA, which would be interesting now. What's been your most impactful contribution, and what are you most proud of?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I've had so many wonderful experiences as either members or chairs of, RSI, and was where I think around 26, 2017, we had an opportunity to really iterate the research agenda for the profession. And recently, I serving on the RSI Commission again, we got to reiterate that, and something that we're publishing soon in JAPA, some surveys we did. I think I believe that the research agenda is an important space. Chairing Governance Commission was an amazing experience because it really helps you understand the complexity that is our AAPA and how this governance works, and how I like to explain to PA students and anybody who'll listen of kind of the how a bill goes to Capitol Hill version in the AAPA in our arms of governance. So just that space and be able to have a hand in making sure that that continues to move forward. You mentioned the AMA experience, and I just completed 4 year stint there. And the AMA House of Delegates goes every 6 months. And to really kind of be a stranger in a strange land in that space, because it's really a different space and an organization with its own priorities. So to be able to advocate for our world in that space, both through private conversations, and I also had the privilege to testify in the reference committees, and I did, was really, it's an interesting opportunity to see how others view us, And maybe see the most jaundiced view of it, because that organization is, they are unapologetically advocating for physicians. And while I can disagree with some of the ways they do that, I have a full understanding of how they are involved with that process. So I got to understand their governance very well as well. You talk about things that I'm proud of or impactful, and I gotta say, I think with my leadership style and my relationships with the PA world, probably the most impactful things don't show up on headlines. Most impactful things show up as conversations, being in a room where maybe something could have gone off the rails, but it didn't. I think it's that kind of quiet, soft, relational things that will never show up on the PA history website, but I know formed history.
Wow. You always say you like to be a fly on the wall, and it sounds to me like you were the fly on the wall at the AMA. And thank you for being there. Let's sort of talk a little bit about the 2016 Optimal Team Practice Task Force. The concept of optimal team practice has certainly been central to modernizing PA legislation across the country. And in Arizona, we dealt with that a number of years ago. For our viewers, can you explain what this means and why it matters to working PAs?
Yeah, and when I think of the optimal team practice story, I think about it as a moment of in history when we spent some time really with a blank piece of paper. Truthfully, it was a blank whiteboard, but a blank whiteboard of what did a group of people think, where our profession was and where were we going. And it was really an opportunity to have that conversation. And it all hung around this kind of, this headline of optimal team practice, which was more of a historical term these days, as now we have conversations about modernizing PA practice. But it settled around a couple of pillars that I think are still present in our days, because we knew that this was going to be an ongoing advocacy story. And the first of these stories is that in probably the most controversial is this concept of not having a kind of a professional tether to a physician as a part of your license. Now, people talk about that as independent practice. And what I think about conversations around independent practice is that people who are bringing it up are looking for a fight. Because, first of all, I think it's really hard to describe independent practice, what that is out in the world. And people say, well, it's like physician practice. Well, that's not really the story as it was ever intended. The story as it is intended and continues to be is that we want to make sure there are not barriers for your practice. We can want to make sure that there are for PAs, you are not too complicated administratively to hire. And as it turns out, that's starting to show up. Another piece of this story is we're very interested in having you being able to bill under your own name, under your own NPI. Because otherwise, you become administratively invisible. Another important space around a profession is that we regulate ourselves. And that happens through state boards. And what came out of there, and we still stand by, is that we believe there should be a PA board made up of a majority of PAs so that we can do this just like every other profession. For other pieces of the story, really, we had, six key elements. And yes, these kind of get as kind of marketing stories, but for folks looking to understand, like, well, what's the current state? Where are we at? And how does one get involved with this? Is that in the APA policy, you can go to APA governance and look at the current policy book, which is what the House delegates does, and there is these model state legislation section. And when something big like this, like OTP was, like six key elements are, what happens is it shows up in that section. So anybody at any point can have this conversation in our HOD community. So I think that's where it was and where are we at now? We knew this was going to be hard. We knew it was going to be state by state. Turns out it is hard. It's state by state, and we're making good progress.
Yeah, well said. And in terms of OTP, one of my pet peeves is the one you mentioned about self-regulation. And I had the opportunity of serving on the Arizona Regulatory Board of PAs for 16 years, two 8-year sessions. And the opportunity, and at that time, PAs, we moved it to PAs where 50% of the board, with two MDs, two DOs, and two patient advocates, but still they had a major saying. And the opportunity of managing the issues within our own profession is incredibly empowering and important. And I think, I don't know how many states have that now. It used to be five, there may be six or seven, or but we have an uphill battle for that to occur. And making that occur in states is going to be a very powerful, for our profession. And I wish we would move faster on that. But realizing at the state level, it's a difficult, it certainly is an uphill battle, don't you think?
Yeah, oh, state advocacy is huge. State advocacy is very important, be and it's a complicated space, right? Because we have our state constituent organizations who are boots on the ground, and we have the AAPA who's supporting that. And we knew, back in this 2016, 2017 era that there was going to need to be support. Yes, we could have a national space, but we needed support for the states. And I can say that I'm really happy to say now that I'm kind of in APA's CVA or APA as a president-elect, being able to see the efforts that we are as we're building our advocacy shop, and being able to build the ways that we can work directly with these state organizations. And I can say that that's improving every day. And it improves a couple ways. Yes, it takes money, but it also takes know-how. So to be able to walk with our state COs and walk with their lobbyists to be able to find best practices is really the state of play these days. And I'm happy to say that it's moving forward.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's move on. You currently chair the AAPA's Artificial Intelligence Task Force. I was talking with Clay Walker earlier, who served with you on that, and had some very positive things to say about that work. This is a critical moment for our profession as AI transforms healthcare and healthcare education. So, what is the vision for this task force, and what should PAs understand about AI's role in the future? And talk to us a little bit about promising applications and concerns and challenges.
Yeah, so of course we know task force are kind of created an end for a specific reason, and this was a year-long task force that ended this past May, and our charge really was to bring in policy to the House of Delegates that had more of an evergreen story, because AI is moving really exponentially, and it's hard for our brains to even have the concept of how fast exponential work does. So what we did as a group, and I had the privilege of being asked to chair it, is the way we approached it was a kind of a literature review of what was happening in our spaces and what were best practices for the world around us. And we took it in terms of how are we relating to our scholarship? How are we relating to patients? What did we think were important to be in the healthcare system and checks and balances in that space? So it was really a great opportunity to work with a group to A, see what's out there on the scholarly level, B, have internal conversations of what we thought it should be, and then once we had work, be able to float it by some influential people in our community to be able to get a sense of that story. So what we were able to do is really create a framework for in our policy to how to process this moving forward, knowing the result changes. So that was the AI task force. Because, and I think that there was a time that we were saying AI is coming. Well, AI is here. And it's not that it will someday be in healthcare, it is currently in healthcare. And let's talk about some kind of surprising things that I think are happening, because this is something I'm in every day. I'm in the scholarship in this area, and something that has been kind of the first out of the gate is this ambient AI story of how the AI is kind of be able to listen to you and help you with this huge pain point in healthcare, and that is the medical record and writing your notes. You know, the concept of people doing pajama time, finishing up their notes after their kids go to bed, was common, and everybody was doing it, and it was creating a huge dissatisfier and burnout in healthcare. And what we're starting to hear from the deployment of this work is that people love it. People love working with it. It has really come through in the promise of that story. So the concept that we would have a healthcare tech that improved our lives as clinicians, right? You know, anybody who went from paper charts to EMRs and the iterations of that didn't think that could ever be possible, right? Because the EMR was built for the computer, not for the people. So I think that that's one thing that's here. Let's talk a little bit about where I think it might be going. And one of the places I think it's going to be able to tell the story is that when this first comes out, we're talking 6 months after the first version of ChatGPT is on the market, a story was floated around in the media of someone whose child had a lot of disparate symptoms that just were difficult to diagnose. And this woman, before this was a thing that people were doing, just dumped all this kid's medical record into the AI. And then it came out as a differential and said, well, maybe you've got tethered cord syndrome. She takes this kid to a pediatric neurosurgeon and says, yeah, he's got tethered cord syndrome. Does a small operation and the kid's fine. I want a future where nobody has to take their kid to 20-some specialists. Yes, when it's complicated, I think that I want a future where consulting your AI is the standard of practice for everyone. Because if you missed, and yes, we understand zebras and horses and all that story, but something to help us prioritize those things. Now, does it come easy? No, I think that we need to be able to create those models. We need to validate those models. We need to understand where liability exists, because there's a liability of not using it. There's a liability of getting it wrong when you use it. I'm not trying to suggest complicated things are simple, but I do believe we have a powerful tool. Now, you mentioned concerns and problems. And something that I'm trying to sort out is, here's an example. We mentioned I was a paramedic. As it turns out, when I was a paramedic, I knew all the streets of my town. And if I didn't know a street in the town, we had a map book that I had to pull out and flip through the book and try to figure out what it was. And yes, sometimes I got lost. So my brain knew all the streets of the town. Finding the answer was difficult, and sometimes the system failed. Well, now I guarantee you, in that EMS system, they've got a GPS. And people don't know all the streets of the town. They don't have to. And they always get there and they never get lost. And sometimes they get around traffic that wasn't there. So there's this concern about de-skilling and losing knowledge in the ways of doing things. And I think, you know, something that I am involved with is research around competency in health professions education. And I think that what we haven't resolved is what are the important must-need know things there? What are the things we can't forget? What are the human things we can't forget? Because I'm not here to argue that me knowing all the streets, while it's great for my ego, sometimes I got lost. And that lo getting lost delayed care. We've got to find the answer here so that we don't get lost and to be able to use those things. So I think it's a problem, but it's a problem we need to overcome.
Yeah, wow. Well said. And we could spend another hour on that for sure. And and thanks for your work on that. Let's move on to, your current role as president-elect of the AAPA, and as you look forward to next year, what are your priorities for the profession? And really, what's the greatest opportunities and challenges that you see coming up in the next couple of years?
Well, first of all, I'm humbled to be with a lot of amazing leaders. And we've had an organization that has created our priorities over time. We've talked about some. We've talked about modernizing PA practice. We haven't talked about title change yet, but that certainly remains a priority. I can say that it's a priority to continue to be nimble and responsive to the environment around us. And I think that members are starting to see how maybe we're even more responsive than we had been in the past. And that's not an accident. That's a desire to be relevant and current and representing our members in the healthcare system. And that happens through a lot of internal kind of staff processes and volunteer processes that enable us to be able to be nimble in those spaces. So to be, continue to be really our voice and action, a voice of our profession and from our members is evergreen. And I'm really happy to say that I think that's better than it's been. Really, in a long time, through a lot of efforts of some smart folks, smart, capable people on staff. Now, I had an opportunity to ask a dear friend of mine and former APA president, Beth Smolko, as we were texting back and forth, and I said, it's hard to know where your fingerprint goes in this, right? Because it's a complicated organization. And I think she said something that I thought was pretty wise, and it was said, you will probably spend your time finishing a lot of projects that other people started. But if you're any good, it's possible you may start a few projects that other people have to finish. And that is an evolving story, but let me tell you something that's on my mind. Something that's on my mind is the healthcare workforce and the challenges in front of us. And let's just talk about just numbers, just sheer numbers, and the fact that you can't name a specialty, you can't name an area of medicine that has enough. So no problem, we don't need any more. Yes, maybe some regional variation, but everything has a need. And we're setting a space where baby boomers are going to need us more and more every day. And I think there's two ends of the spectrum that we can have an effect on. I'm very interested in the needs of early career PAs in their transition to practice. I'm very interested in that space. I think that as our clinical sites become more difficult, we're going to have more and more troubles getting people on board for that story. One of the reasons is, an age-old way of us being initiated, really, as practicing clinicians, where people physicians who own their own practice. And that's just happening fewer and fewer times. Now we have physicians who are employees or who are union members who are asking, what's in it for me? And yes, it's a wide variety story. And yes, there are still amazing physicians we work with, but we just know that's a challenging space. So this concept of the PA profession taking responsibility for our transition to practice. And I think there's a lot of answers to that question. That's one end of the spectrum. But I mentioned the baby boomers. And we do have a healthcare system for all its flaws. People are living longer and people are productive and happy and want to engage longer. I'm also interested in that spectrum of our workforce as well. How can folks maybe thinking about retirement, thinking semi-retirement, what are ways folks can continue to engage and be happy to engage? Because we don't have enough people. And I think we need to get people on faster, and I maybe people productive and happy longer.
Yeah, wow. Well said. And as a card-carrying baby boomer, and if I remember the statistics correctly, I probably represent 6.8% of the profession. We appreciate those thinking about, our future, our healthcare, and what's happening now and when we retire. So, I'm very impressed with what you had to say, about some of the things that you're looking at. Thank you so much for that. Moving on, you've published and presented extensively on topics ranging from, islet cell transplantation to artificial intelligence, telehealth, educational, professional burnout. What drives your scholarly work, and what themes, connect, to those topics?
So I think that, the map through those topics happened to be where I was at the times, right? And the islet cell work was amazing in that I had a chance to be an intramural research fellow at the National Institutes of Health. And I managed a primate protocol, and we were working on how to take islet cells out of a pancreas and be able to inject them into the portal vein of another animal at the time, and people are doing this with people as well. And that time in my life was really learning the research process in and amongst world-class researchers. It was this amazing community of practice because I had a legitimate role to play while at the same time sitting at the feet of masters. You mentioned this the concept of the telehealth story that happened to be a place I was. So I was at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, PA Leadership and Learning Academy as an academic fellow. And that was a time where your cohort was assigned something to do. And we were assigned telehealth. Now, the timing was amazing because I start this in the fall of 2019. We don't know that in the spring of 2020, the whole world is going to know what telehealth is about. So that was just dumb luck on our part. And it was just an opportunity to be on the ground in that conversation to say, how do we teach? How can we provide resources for PA education to be able to teach students how to do telehealth? So that hits that space. Some of the other work in AI is when I first got my hands on AI, I qualitatively knew that this was a different thing. Like, I don't know, like when somebody picks up the first telephone or sends their first email, I think they know, that time in history, that was a different thing. And I think I felt that we had hit a new era. So suddenly that was in that space. Whereas I described my previous research endeavors as kind of where I was. Now, as I'm past PhD story, now you're in a space where you can start to develop your research, develop your lines of inquiry. And while there's a lot of high-minded big words I can use for this, I'm somebody who gets to ask interesting questions and finds ways to answer them. And the good news is that I'm in a space where I get to ask the questions I want to ask and find those answers. Now, whether you're funded for that or not funded for that, like it's a different story, right? I can do a lot more with money than I can do without money. But I'm here to say that whatever interesting question you want to ask, with whatever resources you have, you can find a pathway to continue to pathway. So now I'm in this really exciting era. It's not just happened to be where I'm at or a thing I'm assigned. It's these are the things that I want to do. And I have a kind of two big areas that are my lines of inquiry and a bunch of little ones. And probably the one side is AI in healthcare, and the other side is competency-based education. And a sweet spot that's magic is when they somehow connect. It doesn't always happen, but when I can do that, that's very gratifying.
Yeah, perfect. And that leads me into my next question. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because I want to leave some time for some questions. But let's talk about your PhD in health professions education from the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Your dissertation defined competency-based expectations for new PA graduates through entrustable professional activities. Talk a little bit about the EPAs, and your work on that, and why is this so important?
Yeah, so we know that in the PA profession, we have competencies for the PA profession. And that has been created over time. There's a history of it through the four orgs, and now it sits in our policies. And competencies are kind of larger pieces. They're medical knowledge with some subcompetencies, interpersonal skills. They're kind of large things, but they're hard to assess. So enter in the CBME framework a tool. Another tool called an EPA. And an EPA is what are the clinical expectations? What are the things you can do as an expert and see somebody do it and know they've done it? For instance, one would be to take a history and physical. And if you think about how these frameworks overlap, if you have the EPA to perform a history and physical, as it turns out, those make the competencies visible. To do a history and physical, you need to have medical knowledge. You need to have interpersonal skills. You need to be able to access the medical record, all these pieces that make that thing happen. So, as it turns out, when you see somebody do this thing, you can now highlight what they're competent at and to be able to determine at what level you trust them to do in the future. That's the nutshell of that story. And what I was able to do is that in 2016, 2017, PAEA Past Presidents Association had kind of created a committee consensus around what some of they could be. Our competencies changed, but that first group by Lo Henry and colleagues said that, honestly, we need to be able to have a Delphi study. So that's what I did, is a Delphi study. So we were able to come up with 12 EPAs, now exist in my dissertation, and now I'm in revisions with JPAEA to get those published.
Yeah, and great work, and thank you for doing that. Let's jump forward to probably the biggest news of the last couple of weeks. And as the Department of Education released its definition of the professional degree programs as part of the implementing of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. This definition excludes, at least today, as far as I know, the both NPs and PAs from the higher federal student loan limits, despite both professions requiring graduate level education and leading to licensure. And under this proposal, PAs and NP students would be capped at, $20,500 per year with a $100,000 lifetime limit, while programs like medicine and law and dentistry would qualify for much more. And so I'm sure this is something as president-elect and the leaders of the academy are deeply involved in. Talk a little bit about that, sort of as we conclude today.
Absolutely. It's an example of how PA advocacy so frequently is about vigilance. And I can say that this conversation around these student loans has been percolating for the past year or so. It's only become really hot and evident for everyone now that it's gone off the rails. And I can say the AAPA federal advocacy people have been closely following this story and working hand in hand with PAEA on the story, because of course it affects a big part of their world. And the way this story had developed, how it evolved, whereas at first there was some concern about it, but as we were watching, all the language was starting to go in our favor. Like all the things we were worried about, suddenly we were being included as this specific nomenclature as a professional degree. It all fit us fine. And it's an example of how vigilance is important, because everything was concerning, fine, perfect, until it was not. And at that last pace, that last space, PAs, as well as a long of other things, NPs, theological degrees, or a lot of things that were getting kicked off this story. And a couple of things. One, what does this mean? What do I think it means? What is the impact of this story? I think there is a false story going around that if somehow we cut off access to low interest loans, that academia is just going to suddenly decrease the cost of everything. I think that's magical thinking. I think anybody associated with academia knows that it's that one-to-one thing isn't going to happen, because I think that people with money will always find a way. And I think people who don't have money will somehow be in a situation where they're getting loans that are high interest that they're spending well into their retirement to pay off, just for the sole, sin of wanting to serve their community. So I think that it really hurts the people who want to help. So I think that's why it's important. I don't think it's going to do the thing that the people who are advocating for it think it's going to do. So what do we do? Where are we at? So first of all, AAPA has been on this story, and there's an internal group at AAPA that's staff and some senior staff essentially, and they are monitoring a number of things in our world. So when this comes out, these folks are on it, having the conversations, enabling us to get a statement out. May have been the first medical association to have something out on it, if not one of the first. Second, a strategy of moving forward. And the first strategy people may have seen is essentially where we are getting a petition signed for as many people. And as of this past Friday, there were 40,000 people in counting on that petition. to be able to send to the EP, or to the Department of Education. And that's one piece of story. And that one enables us to speak to them. Two, helps us understand who cares about this in this world for further advocacy. Some things that are happening behind the scenes is that our federal advocacy team have been in close contact with key staff and legislators to be able to highlight this as a problem. Because the next step is what does this exist as? It exists as rulemaking. And the next thing that's going to open up is the request for comment on rulemaking. So when that opens up, probably January or so, but we don't know, we will engage with everyone to be able to get as many comments in this thing to be able to say how this is hurting PAs, how is this hurting the healthcare system, and how is this hurting patients.
Wow. And thank you and many people for, representing us at this important time. I have a couple more questions and I'd like to open it up, to folks who are here. But one question I always ask folks is about what they do outside of, professional politics. You manage an impressive array of professional responsibilities while being a husband and a father of two. How do you maintain balance and what role does your family play in your success and what do you do for fun?
So I maintain balance because I've learned by not maintaining balance, right? So I've had certainly have times where I got out of balance and I understand what that feels like and I don't like it. So one is learning from my failures to be able to say how do I go about every day? One is my calendar. I'm very I do what my calendar tells me, but I'm very careful about what I put on my calendar. So I can do anything I can schedule. But there's a certain time in the day that unless it's an emergency, I'm done. And I'm with the people I'm around and who I love. And that's been a very important thing. And if something's an emergency, I have to ask myself, how did I get myself in a situation where something was an emergency? Because I'm not an EMS anymore. No one, I don't have a pager going off anymore. So what is the emergency if I didn't create it? So that's feedback in my life that I got myself in those spaces. As far as my family, they are the important space. I have this one moment in life. I have my son who's turning 18 soon, my daughter who's in middle school, and they're just joy of my life. My wife and I have been together for a long time and just really enjoy each other's presence. So to be able to be there with and for them is an amazing, is enough for me.
Well, well said. Well, tell me a little bit about baseball and aviation.
Well, I naturally lead towards those things. It's funny. The Washington Nationals, for a while had a t-shirt and it had wonk, and it said that a wonk is actually know backwards. So to be a wonk is somebody who knows something backwards and forwards. And I am a detailed person who likes kind of wonky specialty things, right? You could see it in my career. I did heart surgery, I did cardiac electrophysiology, these things that you can endlessly go in those spaces. So aviation, I had really the pleasure to get my pilot's license when I was in Connecticut with some amazing man there. And baseball, I think the things that really connect those is that they're activities, but they also have a history and they have a context, and there's always something happening. And I really believe that I really can get, to people who try to tell me baseball is boring, that then I tell them that they don't understand baseball then, because as something is happening every single second. The question is, did you see it and did you understand it? And in some cases, that thing is happening ties to 100 years of history and ties to what may happen in the next 6 months. So that thread, that wonkiness pulls me in, which is pretty typical for my, personality.
That's great. My mom, rest her soul, was such a baseball fan that when I went to visit her, if it was during baseball season, she would just, bake me some banana bread and send me home. And it was great. Dave, last question before we open it up is, what advice do you have for our DMSE students, our DMSC faculty and our alumni in terms of what they can do in terms of advocacy as part of our profession.
Yeah, I think the most important thing, every all of all the above that you had just said, is the most important advocacy you do is the work you do every day. Is that I feel like there was a time we went through a long time in our history. People weren't really sure what PAs were. Maybe they misunderstood PAs, but now something different has changed. When you talk about a PA, somebody says, "Oh, yeah, I have a PA," or "My mom had a PA." Or my uncle had surgery and the PA was there every day. That's a different story. That's a different advocacy when the work you do, wherever you are, affects every single one of us. So I really think that's the start. That is the start, is just take what you do seriously and know that we are a small enough community that we represent every single one of us. I don't think that, like, if a physician or a nurse hears that some other physician or a nurse did something unfortunate, bad, embarrassing, it's not like they feel that. It's not like said, "Oh no, they're bad for physicians." But if something bad happens with a PA, other PAs say, "Oh no, that's awful," because we're a tight community and we represent each other.
Yeah, very well said. Well, let's open it up to any comments or questions, and I'm going to pick on a couple of people. That would be Dr. DePalma and Dr. DePalma. Yeah, any comments that you might have to share with us today?
I love the doctor's diploma.
Sorry, trying to get off of mute and get the video back on. It's the Doctor's DePalma. But no, just thank you for sharing your history, your wisdom, your enthusiasm and support for the profession. I guess I get questions sometimes from students, they're getting their DMSC, what's next? How can they get involved in leadership or make more of an impact in the profession? And I think that might help a lot of our students. Are there any ideas or words of wisdom you might have?
Yeah. So many of our organizations, I spoke glowingly of my experience at APA CVS, and my experience at APA has been similar, is that there is such need for work and such an opportunity for growth and development, is that I would say start with the organization you feel associated with, right? Whether that's your state or your specialty or your special interest, wherever you are. We have our place in our world that is in that space. And any leader in that space, if you just said, "Hey, I'm interested in getting involved." If any leader in our world says anything other than, "I have ideas for you," then they're not doing their job as a leader. So I think that you start where you are, you touch it where you can, and you grow from there.
Great. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Since I got tagged in, I'll
Yes.
just fill in. I just appreciate your approach to things because I feel like, particularly in this climate, and I know, student aid, but there's a lot that's involved that a lot of people tend to be very reactionary. And it's just nice that there's level-headed thinking that's taking place. So, we definitely appreciate, particularly in the education world where your approach and where your mindset and what you talked about with that. So.
I appreciate it because I think that we need to never lose sight that we have agency. We as a profession, as citizens, as people involved, as long as we have, a pulse, we have an opportunity to engage and we're stronger together.
Well said. Thank you, guys. Other folks who might have a comment or a question. Just unmute yourself.
David, this is Jim Ally. Nice to meet you, and thank you for tonight's presentation. It's inspiring, if nothing else. I mean, it's just been listening to you and listening to you speak for how you started and how you got to where you are is it's a pretty amazing tale. So I just give you lots of respect for what you've done and how you've done it. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. So you liaison to the AMA for 4 years. Are you going to continue that position, or you've moved on from that?
So I've moved on for that. The way that works is that they are 2-year terms that can be renewed once. So I had the full ride, and their AMA is every their house is every 6 months. So I have had the benefit of attending eight of their houses. That being said, even if I were not limited, I think there's really something in being able to pass the torch for other people. Stephen Lewia is there right now. So first of all, he's a leader in his own right and has done great work. But for him to have another opportunity for someone else in our community to be able to get those spaces, I think is just as important.
So I was elected, I guess, to be the liaison to the American Academy of Family Physicians. I'm the president of the Society for PAs of Family Medicine. And it was my first visit this last, they call it a Congress, their last Congress. And I was pleasantly surprised at the reception I got. In addition, they are very pro PAs. And the chair came up and I was introducing myself. And she said, "Oh yeah, you're the physician associate that's visiting with us."
Love that.
And I was like, I was kind of taken back, but I tried not to react to it. And she said, "I just want you to know, we have a lot of respect for our PAs, and we really appreciate you being here." And this is the well, she's the immediate past chair now. And I talked to her about a sort of a collaboration between the AAFP and the AAPA. And we had a follow-up conference call. It hasn't. It's still really in formative phases, but they showed extreme interest in collaborating for whatever that means. I don't really know what it means, but as I find out, I'll certainly bring it to whoever's desk that belongs on and try to move that forward.
Well, certainly, thank you for your service on that point. And I think it really highlights all of the opportunities that we have for relationships. I think that and even within the AMA situation, where it can be kind of notoriously a different space, there's individuals there. All these people, just like our house, is from every single organization. And they're not a monolith. These are different people who really, at the end of the day, want to serve their patients just like we do. And I think that's certainly true in the family practice community because there's such a desperate need for primary care and family practice work. Nobody knows that better than the AFP. So the concept that they see us as allies and an opportunity to, further the work they love, I can see that. So I'm so glad you're there to represent.
Thank you. It's been a great choice. So thank you for your leadership as well. Sandra, thank you for your leadership as well.
Thank you, guys. Anybody else that has a comment or question? All right. Well, let me wrap this up. Once again, thank you, David, for your time today participating in our master class. We so enjoyed our time together. And we could spend another hour, but we I'll have things to do in the evening. For the rest of you, please join us on January 26th in the new year for our next master class. Our guest will be Richard Dean. Rick is a nationally recognized PA scholar and educator with over 100 published peer-reviewed journal articles, written many book chapters, and was the co-editor of Clinical Procedures for PAs. He is the current editor-in-chief of JAPA. So please put this on your schedule and I hope you can join us. And again, Dave, thank you so much for being here this evening. And thanks to all of you for joining us today. And the best to all of you during this holiday season. And just know we care about you and best wishes. So thank you. All right. Thanks, David.
All right, thank you for a delightful evening. I really appreciate the conversation and look forward to seeing the next time around.
Absolutely. I will edit this tomorrow and get it off to you to look at. And, in the next couple of days after you see it, we'll post it for our students. But,
I love it.
it's wonderful things. And,
Wonderful.
it was good to see you in San Diego. And
Yes.
I'll look forward to, doing things down the road.
Sounds good. Be well. Have a good night.
All right, bye-bye.